This episode is brought to you by Joule, the immersion circulator for sous vide by Chef Steps. Order now at chefsteps.com/joule.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello and welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live on the Heritage Radio Network every Tuesday from roughly 12 to roughly 12:45. Roberta's Peach, we at Bushwick, Brooklyn. Joined, as usual, with Nastasia the Hammer Lopez. How you doing, Stas?
Good.
I'm using Nastasia's normal microphone, and it's even more kind of like...
worse than yours, right?
It's even worse than mine. I'm surprised. I always thought I was giving you the good one, but no, it's all like bent and crooked. We got Dave in the booth. How you doing, Dave?
I'm good. Not bent and crooked in here.
Wow. Why don't you just lord it over us, Dave?
I think I just did.
All right. But listen, you're going to want to get your telephones or whatever you use, Skypages or whatever you do, to call in your questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128, because today in the studio we have two special guests. We have Elias Cairo from Olympia Provisions. I always want to say Olympic, and then you'll shoot me in the face.
I'll support you.
All right. In Portland, we met how long ago?
Six months ago?
Yeah, at the Oregon Truffle Fest. Uh-huh. And I had the great good fortune of going to a special dinner at OP, and fantastic. So I'll just say, for those of you that are going to Portland, legit. I'm going to give it the nice Cooking Issues legit stamp.
Awesome.
And we also have in the studio Samantha. What's your last name, Samantha?
Chulik.
And you are a food PR person, huh?
That is correct.
Wow. So we're just going to get this out of the way now. So did you start out wanting to be a food PR person, or are you just a general? By the way, do you find the term flack offensive or not?
No, we're good.
All right. So did you start out as kind of a general purpose flack, so you could either be selling thumbtacks or food or cars, or are you one of these people that actually enjoys food?
I strictly food and beverage.
All right. So as we like to say, one of the good ones. Yeah. Because in a lot of businesses, I'm serious. You know, Elias, you know what I'm talking about. It's like you get these people in there, they don't really care what the hell they're selling.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Nice. It's like Dave over here. He doesn't care what he's recording.
Just noise.
Wow, is that really what you think of me?
I'm just busting you because of the microphone crack, Dave. Come on. You know it's all love in here.
Do you feel better now?
No, I feel slightly dirty. So we got a bunch of cool stuff. Call in your questions, like I say. So, you know, for those of you that don't know Elias, he's like a hunter, a cure master. You own these two restaurants, right?
Two real restaurants and then three fast casual, like hot dog beer bar type places.
And then also wrote, what is it now? Wrote a billion years ago and then came out like a year and a half ago, right?
Yeah.
It takes a billion years to write a book.
It's the slowest thing I've ever done.
Yes, I'm just going to get this out of the way right now. My kids, both my freaking kids, decide last week, in the middle of me writing a book that has a lot of meat cookery, that this is going to be the time that they go vegetarian.
Oof.
You know what I'm talking about. It happens, right?
Yeah.
And so here it is. I'm like, you know, what am I going to eat? A whole freaking crown roast by myself? I'm going to eat like I'm going to do like a Chateaubriand for one? Like, what the heck am I going to do here?
Invite the neighbors over. Make good friends.
Yeah, but you know what? I'm just not like that. I'm not like that. So I don't know how it is in Portland. First of all, by the way, you guys over there at Olympia Provisions, the only people in Portland who are guaranteed to be working at any given time. Am I right?
So true.
Yeah, I mean, like, what is it with Portland and the lack of, like, work?
They're there. Not everybody moves to Portland to work. Some people move there just to retire, enjoy the frickin' rain.
But people are retiring when they're, like, 20.
I know. A lot of them. I know. I get slack all the time for being hardworking.
Yeah. Nastasia's got her Portland face on, which is, I can't believe nobody's working here. Why? Really, it's all jealousy. It's like, why didn't we do this?
Yeah.
But anyway, I don't know how we got on the subject of working. Working. But anyway, so this book came out in, the end of 15 or something like that?
Yeah, October.
So it's called American Equality. How do you pronounce the title? American Charcuterie.
Great question.
Olympia. Do you start with the Olympia Provisions?
I say Olympia Provisions.
And then American Charcuterie Equality Meats.
Yep. I say cured meats and tails by Olympia Provisions from an American charcuterie.
Now, there you go.
See how I had to read that?
I like that. But anyway, what I'm going to say about this book, and we actually talked about it a little bit in Portland, mm-hmm. it's a super pretty book. I think it's like a really, really beautiful book. And I mentioned this to you, and you actually said, I think, unless my memory is like zonked, I didn't have that much sparkling wine that day, that you know, one of my favorite series of cookbooks in the world is the Time Life series of cookbooks that came out in, I guess, starting in the late 60s and going through the early 70s, where they go around the world. And the cool thing about it is, well, the cool thing now is you can get them for like $2 a piece. They're amazing. Still free. You get the whole set. People, go out right now. Go on eBay. They're get the whole set.
A must-have.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely must-have. And they hired... Not that food photographers aren't real photographers. Please don't get me. I don't want to hear it. But they hired people who for instance, Sports Illustrated photographers or, general subject photographers. And so these books have some of the sickest photography anywhere. And so a lot of the photos you have here they're modern. They're not from the 70s.
Sure.
But they it's printed on that kind of matte paper, so it's got that awesome kind of flat feel to it.
Totally.
And, you've got a lot of, not straight recipe shots in it.
Totally.
So I think it's a really, really, really beautiful book.
Thank you.
And I also I like the way that it's, it's also personalized. You know what I mean? So it reminds me of anyone who writes nowadays is going to be obviously more, not that he wasn't technically minded, Bertoli's book, Cooking by Hand, right, was, I think, an extremely personal book that was tackling some technical subjects before anyone else had written on these kinds of subjects before. And I still think it's I haven't read it in over a decade.
It's still such an amazing book.
Yeah, but I mean, great book. But so I really like books that are personal, but that tackle real issues in the kitchen. And you can tell when you go through it that this is, written. I know some of the recipes are yours. Some are pastry chefs. Mm-hmm. Some are a bunch of different people, but written by people who actually know what they're doing. It's not like you made this once and now you've written it down and that's it, which is, an unfortunate thing in cookbooks.
Hey, speaking of reading, can you quickly read that thing I put in there?
Oh, God dang it. What, the pre-roll ad? We're going to do some business?
We got to do some business.
Today's program is brought to you by Modernist Pantry, providing magical ingredients for the modern cook. For free videos, recipes, tips, and tricks, visit blog.modernistpantry.com.
Back to your regularly scheduled program.
Nailed it! All right, let me see the book for a second. I want to read this quote that I think Nastasia is going to love the most out of the introduction, because this is going back to a work ethic in Portland. So you grew up a Greek family in freaking Utah,
Salt Lake City, Sandy.
What the heck's that all about?
Oh, there's a lot of Greeks out there.
Really?
Yeah. It's the same climate as the Spartan and mountain Greeks.
Really?
Sagebrush, cold winters. There's a ton of great Greek food.
Really?
Yeah. So my dad moved out there because the Kennecott copper mine was originally owned by a Greek man, and he brought all of his hardworking Greek friends from the mountains to come mine it, and then they came back and told their children how amazing Salt Lake City is. At least that's how the story goes. Ooh. And there's a ton of Greeks and a ton of Greek churches out there, and
is there a big culture clash between the Greek Orthodox and the Mormon?
Michelle and I and Billy Valamis, if you're out there, were the only three Greeks in our elementary school, and the rest were all LDS.
Wow.
LDS are beautiful people. There's a little quote in there, a little story in there, that we got called to the principal's office because we stunk too much like garlic and the kids couldn't focus, and my father walked in and super Greek, thick accent, and be like, "Your children smell like detergent," and whipped us out of school. And took us, he's like, "You're not going there. We're teaching you." And the rest of the year we stayed at home and
homeschooled.
Your
children smell like detergent. Well, this is going to be apropos. So this is a quote about your dad.
Mm-hmm.
Paraphrasing what he might say to you. "Need glue? Go cut into the pine tree and mix the sap with sand to make it pliable. Oh, you were planning on buying glue? Are you lazy or just stupid?"
So true.
Right?
Yeah.
And Nastasia, Nastasia didn't know you, but now she loves you because that's that's her whole attitude.
Yeah.
Her whole attitude on it. Also, another thing Nastasia's going to like about it, you spend some time cooking in Switzerland.
Yeah.
At this crazy, did you see this place, Nastasia? He worked at this restaurant where it's someone just, I don't know how the hell they got the building there, but it's like a carbuncle shoved onto the side of a freaking mountain.
Yeah.
What's that place called?
That one's called the Hotel Asher or Berg Restaurant Asher. It's in Appenzeller. It's just on the fucking
label. Where is it?
That's in the northeast corner of Switzerland. That's in the Canton Appenzeller, but that whole region is called St. Gala. So like Austria, Germany, the Bodensee, Lake Constance, all that right there. It's the mountains right above there.
How the hell do they get their... first of all, like, where are their customers coming from?
Yeah, like the Swiss are super hardy people and they love to eat when they're hungry. And so like the idea of going on an all-day hike to eat like, you know, a huge smoked meat and a chunk of cheese and like some fruit is just what they love to do. And like you'll be out there hiking thinking you're pretty cool and like a 70-year-old grandma will fly by you just being like, oh, yodeling and cruising up to the...
Did you learn to yodel while you're over there?
No, not very good. I tried.
But Nastassi and I both love the yodeling game on The Price is Right.
Mm-hmm. Yes, beautiful game.
Yeah. Remember that? Who were we making fun of?
Temperature. You need to add that in your book.
The sous vide temperature, like the yodel. And then if you get the wrong temperature, it's overcooked.
I know what you're saying.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
And we were trying to remember the tune. I can never remember the tune. Right? We could never, like, for some reason, it's one of the... You know there's those tunes that just leave your head and you can't get them back in your head? And then there's those tunes, like the theme from Quincy, that go into your head and you can't get them out of your head?
3 weeks later?
Yeah. And, you know, or Rockford Files, for that matter. But Rockford Files, I feel, deserves to be in your head. I mean, you know, Rockford Files and Sanford Son, whenever those theme songs come into your head, you're like, all right.
It's a good day.
That's good. Fair. That's just good business. All right, so before we get too far in, a couple of bones I have to pick, so we might as well fight about it now. We're both lovers of nitrate and nitrites, obviously, in curing. And you make a lot of amusing points about, you know, not kind of worrying about it, because a lot of people are worrying about it, especially over probably on the West Coast. You get all the, right?
Oh,
all
God.
The time.
Literally for everything, that voice.
Yeah. I mean, like... you know, the thing is, I think I've said this on air, but like it's only been the last 3 years that people have gotten through my armor at events. Like usually I can maintain my kind of I'm happy to serve you, customers always right kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. It's only been the past couple of years that somehow it's just like too many hits. And I'm like, I was like, oh. You do the breath.
Breathe.
Yeah. And so Nastassi's like, what the hell is that? Because I always ride her about it. You know what I mean? I always ride her like a pony for showing her displeasure
family
in front
show,
of the
family show.
What? Oh, well, not like that. You know what I'm saying. Dang, man, Dave. Gutter Dave.
And, just trying to protect you.
Anyway, so like, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Only recently I've been But the, so you say that it's 100% illegal to cure meats without, you know, nitrates or nitrates, but super long cure stuff like dry cure, like hams, like prosciutto di Parma, you can do without nitrates. That you need to, not that I think it makes it better, but the classic Italian one nowadays is made without that stuff. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, you can do anything legally if you have the hundreds of thousands of dollars to spend that it's a safe process.
To prove it.
Yeah, you got
to
prove it.
Yes.
You got to prove it. But yes, in general, I think what I think you're probably reacting to, and Harold McGee sent me an email. About Oscar Mayer now is doing their nitrate-free, nitrate-free hot dogs.
Yeah, of course.
Hot dogs. And it says... cured, only the nitrates, of course, this is the standard, only the nitrates naturally found in celery.
Yeah.
Jokers. Like, they should be, everyone should be skewered. This is Whole Foods' fault.
Of course.
100%.
Absolutely.
This is freaking Whole Foods' fault. You know, Samantha, you don't flack for them, do you?
No, I do not.
All right. So, like it's 100% their fault. It's garbage. I mean, the food can taste good, but the labeling is garbage.
Yeah. It's total smoke and mirrors. 100%.
So everybody out there, I want you on all of your labels and in all of your food on your menu to write this. Contains no salt other than that naturally found in the ocean.
That would be great.
Yeah, and then you're like, oh, sea salt. Oh, yeah.
That would be great.
Yeah, right? You can do it. Because it's the same freaking thing. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
It's like you take like 8 billion. What do they do with the rest of the celery?
Well, they just puree it. So they load the soil or chard or whatever they're using for their nitrate thing. They overload the manure with nitrate.
Right.
And so when the spinach or the chard is growing in that, it picks up all the extra nitrate, the exact same compound that is in regular nitrate. Then they puree it, and then they use that as their salt and their nitrate. It's just the same thing. Right. Total loophole. My favorite thing is I called Switzerland, right, where I did my apprenticeship, and I was like, hey, man, you know, what are you guys doing about nitrate? Just total brain fart, like they'd give a living shit about it. And they're like, hey, what are you talking about? We give nitrate to our children when they're sick. Like, it's good for you. It's a vitamin. I don't know what the hell's wrong with you Americans. And I'm like, good conversation. I'm going to leave now.
Yeah. Well, but on the other hand, the Europeans have their own issues, right? I mean, absolutely. Like, every place has its own issues. But before the cooking issues. Hey, Nastasia, flip through there and look at the – do you see the hot dog picture?
Yeah,
I bookmarked it.
Do you want something about it?
No, I just think it's – like, this is the kind of picture I like. Like, a bunch of hot dogs, and then, like, a couple pictures later, this – oh, I know, this inn that's shoved into the side of a mountain. Uh-huh. So, question, how the hell did they get their food into that place?
Depending on where. So, this place is pretty amazing. The one that's called the Asher is because their whole thing is they have these two gigantic limestone water pits behind there. That's the only water they can get up there. So, the water filters through the cliffs and lands in these limestone pits. As soon as they're out of water, they're completely closed for the year, and then they go back to curing meat, hunting meat, and raising meat.
What do you think about that, Nastasia?
That's awesome.
Oh, yeah. They're super freaking amazing. This place up there, to put it into perspective, with two cooks, does about 500 covers at lunch. And they do roshti, which is, you know, boiled potatoes, and that, you know, now there's a tram that goes up the backside and they bring it across on mule, but still, like, the water and all the meat the father and son bring up on mule are like twice a year.
Literal pack mule.
Yeah, the bigger one, the one at the end of the Rothstein Pass, the one where you see these ibex there, this is the path to it. It's up like this cliff and you run across it. That one, the only way to get anything up there is with mule, so everything is brought up on mule. And they do Steinbockpfeffer, which is those ibex that are soured like sauerbraten, and then they slowly braise it, and then they thicken it with blood, and so it makes this, then they can it, and then they put it on the mules, and then they take it up top. And when you get up there, you're also going to have roshti, Steinbockpfeffer, applesauce, and sour cream.
So, like, what's the portion size on that?
It's gigantic.
Really?
Oh,
come
it's
on.
Huge. Yeah, no, like a roshti, go get a charcuterie board or a cheese plate at any one of these places, and it's like for 10 in America.
Well, you hiked up the side of a freaking mountain.
You deserve it.
That's like I was talking to a Sherpa, and he was like, I was like, yeah, how come, you know, you're Buddhist and everything, but you eat meat? He's like, we eat nothing but fat. We live at the top of a freaking mountain.
Imagine.
Yeah, we need so many calories.
A carrot after climbing Everest?
No. You pound yak and yak meat, yak fat, yak butter, and yak milk. I was like, that makes total sense.
Yeah.
Makes total sense to me.
Yeah.
So did you get to go hunting when you were in Switzerland or no?
Yeah, the guy that I worked with that I did my apprenticeship under was the Jägermeister of the Valley. So he owned this hotel and butcher property.
By the way, people, that means hunting master,
yeah,
not
exactly.
The liqueur.
He
of
wasn't
the same
just
name.
The liquor master we got to drink. No. Yeah. So if you wanted to shoot an animal in our valley, you had to go to Bjerger and ask him if there was any unhealthy animals, could you hunt it, where should I do it? And after you shot the animal, you'd bring it to our restaurant and our butcher shop, and we'd process it for you. You know, there was tons of different ways we could process, sell it back to you, buy it off you, use it in the restaurant, but we would cure and ferment and make all of our meat out of, like, you know, 200 to 300 wild animals a month.
So the Jägermeister is literally like a traffic cop for shooting animals.
Exactly. And he knows where they're all at. So, like, every single day he's up super early with binoculars, like, just scoping for animals. And he took me a couple times with him. I was never able to kill an animal, but, like, after year three of me, like, cutting up animals and working my ass off, he's like, tomorrow we go hunting. And I was like, holy shit.
Oh, nice. So, like, what is he like? Take the one with the busted horn. It's not so good in the picture.
Yeah,
is that what he's like?
But he's like, it's like the sick ones. You know, they don't shoot young ones. Like, there's a story here in there where he shot his first elk. It's very hard to find elk up there. And so that's very small herds. And he got an elk from his, like, all the other Jägermeisters met and said, there's this young elk coming up. You follow it until it's sick and you kill it. And he followed it for 14 years. And he kept every one of its sheds. So every time it shedded every year, he followed it. And then he finally shot it stuck in a snowbank. So, like, it was on its deathbed, and he's like, I think the other Jaeger's like, he was actually in Austria, across from Switzerland. He's like, I see your elk, Bjerger, come shoot.
So,
I like that voice, even though they're German.
I like that. So they're predominantly hunting older animals then.
Yeah.
So how's that for cooking?
It's musky, but I love that. Like, I like game funk, you know?
Have you been to the Spanish people who do the raised super old cows? Like,
no.
You know, Jeffrey Steingarten and Harold McGee were like, oh, the seven-year-old cows, blah, blah, blah.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they don't talk like that, but you know what I mean. But, like, meh, meh, meh. I'm Jeffrey Steingarten, meh, meh, meh. No, but I mean, like, you know, it's this thing in Spain. Obviously, everyone in America shies away from old meat in mm-hmm. general. But I mean, just from a cooking standpoint, so are you I mean, do people respond to the different texture well over there? Or like when you're cooking for an American, you can't really translate that kind of a recipe.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, like a 5-year-old Ibex liver, for example, and you'd eat liver all that, like the wild animal liver is so sought after. You're not serving that to anybody in America. They're taking a bite of that. And
like, I know Americans who won't eat deer liver over a year old.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like they're like, you know.
No, God, I love deer liver. I know, but you're absolutely right. Like, I mean, you'll see people hunting that leave 2/3 of the animal out there, and you're just like, yeah, in Europe that does not ride. You're never going to stumble upon like a half clean carcass. It's like whole animal brought out, everything utilized, everything enjoyed, very, very much so.
All right, so by the way, do you do any low temperature cooking with hunting? You ever pull out a circulator and bust it down?
No. I'm so old school. I don't even know what a circulator is. I make takes like, you know, natural fermentation. I know it's amazing. People do God's work with those things. I just don't know how.
Well, I mean, the interesting thing is I never have access to really old meat. So I'm curious about it. Like I've cooked super old meat only occasionally, and you only get it from like weird people. And there was this guy in Chicago who used to sell that kind of meat, but I since found out that he basically, not only should he go to prison, he did go to prison for doing like illegal animal practices. So I don't buy from him anymore.
Probably a good idea.
Yeah, you know what I mean? but anyway, so. Yeah.
Well, I can hook you up. I can find old meat for you for sure. I have a big elk hunt coming up this spring that I'm looking to get like an old bull elk. So if I get one.
Are people worried with older elk now about chronic wasting, or is that people not worry about that anymore? Or like,
I haven't had anybody worry about it in a long time. So yeah.
Nice.
I mean, I'll shoot an old elk. See, I get cow tags, right? Every year, that's where you shoot the female cow. And I usually use those for my meat at home. And that's very often ethically thought. They kill the calves, the very young baby elk, or a cow. And they like that because it's like the veal of it. And I've never been able to do that yet, to shoot like a 6-month-old elk. I always shoot the mom elks.
Now, but from an ethics standpoint, is that if you're shooting the young one, it's like, well, he had a bad shot anyway. It's like he was going to die maybe anyway, yeah. So kill him now.
Yeah. I think ethically people are trying to justify, I don't know why, I try to get the most amount of meat out of animals that I kill, is that if you kill their mom, the calf's probably going to die too. Right. So you have to spend a lot of time like making sure that the calf that you're about, or excuse me, the cow that you're about to kill isn't about to, you know, doesn't have a calf.
Right.
And then you're feeling good about it.
Right. I think people would be shocked. I looked at the numbers a long time ago, but in the East Coast, in hunting areas, like the percentage of deer now, because they don't have anything else here, right? Mm-hmm. But the percentage of deer that are going to end up in a hunter's plate is extraordinarily high, right? I mean, it's more than you'd think.
Oh, out here, I would imagine. Yeah, I mean, it's a 3-day season and like 4,000 elk or deer get killed in a day or something
like
that.
Yeah, it's
like,
that's
insane.
Yeah, it's crazy. Speaking of hunting, so you have brought something.
I did. I'm super happy about this. I do a lot of bird hunting in Oregon, and we talked about it lately, and I know that you wanted to get back into bird hunting at some point in your life.
I've never gotten to do it. I've always wanted to.
You've never done it either.
No, I've always wanted to. Well, that's not true. In Italy, I went on a BS pheasant hunt. It was they're fake. It's fake.
Planted pheasants and bird dogs.
Yeah, it's fake. I didn't feel so good about it. I ate the bird.
It's delicious meat.
Yeah.
And you still get to shoot a gun at a bird.
Yeah. You know, it's not hunting, right? Yeah.
No, it's more, I think it's more for training the dogs and then getting the rifle ready to, or like your shotgun good at shooting. I utilize it once a year.
Yeah.
Like right at the beginning, I try to tune my dogs up. And
this dog in Italy was like so stupid too. It was the dumbest.
It's the worst.
It was like at the very beginning of the season, and we weren't like their real customers. And so they were testing out like their new dog on us. And so Nastasia, people are going to like call. This is how this works, though, people. They take and they disorient the pheasant so that it doesn't immediately take off, right?
Oh, wow, that is really.
And then they put it in a bush. No. You know what bush it's in, right?
They tell you where it's at. Even.
Well, in this scenario, they were shooting it for something, you know, and then they let go of the dog, and the dog's just sitting there scratching its ear.
No. Like,
and they're like, hey, Fido. You know, and they're like, go flush over here. Yeah, and like, I don't know what they call dogs. And it's when we were shooting a piece on ancient cooking techniques, and they wanted us to actually go get the animals, even though it was Roman. Even though the Romans actually would have raised their pheasants in captivity and just broken their necks, and not there wouldn't be all this like, you know, buckshot.
Yeah, not
obviously.
A lot of shotguns in Roman era. Right?
Not too many. You know what I mean? You know, and you know, I doubt the average Roman was sitting there like, you know, hurling rocks at pheasants to try to get. Yeah, I mean, like, you know, this is a sophisticated group of people, and they, you know, they had, you know, they raised pheasants, and they, you know, they definitely, I'm sure the Romans, if they were going to train their dogs, would have done a better job
to catch the pheasant.
Yeah, and so like they started chucking things towards the bush to get the dog to look at the bush.
That's horrible. It's so depressing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then finally, you know, we're sitting there and we're like, oh, and then it takes off. It was a good bird. Tasted good. Although I forget, you're going to have to. So what do you have here? Show me the bird you had. Yeah, you brought here.
I got you a chucker. And this is a true wild Oregon chucker. Not so that these, when you shoot these, they're up on the rim rock way above like the rivers, like the John Day. This one came off of the John Day. And they're non-native to Oregon, but they're the most amazing game birds.
So they're invasive?
They're not invasive. They planted them for game birds, you know, 20 years, 30 years ago, and now they've just done amazing. And so
how do they taste relative to, like, so the size here, they're bigger than a pigeon. They're squabbish size.
They're squabbish, slightly larger. They're about, you know, a little bit smaller than a good grouse or a rough grouse. But they are very plentiful, and they're amazing. They live up in the sagebrush, and so they eat a lot of sage, and so their flavor picks up, like, that real wild sagebrush
nice.
Flavor.
Pass it over.
Yeah. But yeah, they're super fun, and they're like one of the hardest game birds to shoot. Like, your dog will point them maybe sometimes a half a mile out, and you know, you'll get up on your dog and you'll know which direction they're going to fly, and 20 to 30 of them are flush, and you'll miss all of them. And then, you know, one out of 10 you'll probably hit.
All right, so I'm looking at this bird here. I'm terrible at plucking birds, by the way.
Yeah.
I'm just terrible
Perfect
at it.
Perfect time to start.
Yeah, but we're not going to pluck this right now, are we?
Like, no, you don't.
So on a game bird, right, so I've done pheasant not just in that time in Italy, but in France. You know, you go to France and you can buy pheasant on the, you know, on the feather, or whatever they call it, feathered in the, you know, gibier shops. You know what I mean? Or, and you go there. And once those feathers set, man, plucking is a nightmare.
Brutal.
Yes. Is this going to be a similar situation?
You know, chucker, like those desert birds, chucker, quail, grouse, and all the ones that have more fat live in a burlier from hot to cold climate are much easier to pluck than pheasants. Pheasants are the most difficult bird to pluck in the whole world. Very, like, they're just horrible.
I ruined the
animals.
Skin. Oh, yeah. I ruined the skin.
Totally. Yeah, depending on that one, looks like we shot it pretty good, so I don't see many bullet holes
in
it.
Where is it shot?
It looks like it's like in the neck and the wing right there. Mm-hmm. And that could have been a runner. Like, I could have winged it, which is ideal. And then the dog grabs it and brings it to you. But yeah, you know.
Now, you don't hang these things until they start stinking. You're not one of those kind of guys, are you?
This is why I brought you this one. I'm not. I'm usually not. But I was hunting with this guy, and we had like one of those great days where we each got like our limit, which is 15 of those birds in a day. It was an amazing, amazing day. And he told me that he enjoys the flavor of freezing them whole with the guts in them.
And so that's what we got
and
here.
And I have three of them that I haven't ate.
It's still
two
cool.
In my
still
life.
Cool.
And there's so all the, like, this is how he does it. He loves the flavor more. And he's like an epic hunter, and he cooks really, really well.
So he doesn't dress it out. He
doesn't dress it. You know, he'll just freeze it all like this. Let the flavors develop in his freezer. Then he plucks it and then draws all the guts out, and then he roasts it or cooks it further.
So he does draw it before he
cooks it. Yeah,
before he cooks.
Yeah, do that for
sure.
So
it's not like remember that. The woodcock we had.
Oh, that people hang with the guts in.
Oh my god, it was the most disgusting. I liked eating it, but for Nastasia, watching her face was the most disgusting.
The way he ate it, this stuff was flying on my face too. It was disgusting.
So when you're hunting a small bird, right? The flavor probably changes a lot depending on what you puncture, right?
Yeah, well, the biggest flavor I always say about, like, the grouse is the best. You know, grouse live in the forest. The sagebrush, chuckers and other desert Hungarian partridge live in the sage. They pretty much have one diet. But a grouse, like a mountain grouse in the spring, eats berries. And then once it gets into later in the fall, it eats, like, rose hip and gooseberry. And then in the midwinter, it eats pine. Like, pure pine lives off pine and juniper berries. And that's the biggest flavor difference. Because you can see it. When you open up that bird, you open up its crop right here, you'll see what it's been eating. So this one should be full of sage and seed.
Cool. And what do? You cut here and clean out, and then you do the triangle by the butt and rip the stuff out?
Exactly.
Like a smaller version of a chicken?
Absolutely. 100% exactly. Just like that. Yeah.
Beautiful. Uh-huh. All right. Well, we'll post some pictures. It looks like you got clipped on the back a little bit.
There
huh?
it goes. Yeah, maybe that's where it was at. But, I, you know, then again, I haven't ever... I've never frozen a full bird and ate it myself, so it'll
well,
be...
We'll give some... And luckily, this is, you know, a serving size for one, so my kids are just vegetarian, won't have to worry about it. Well, thanks so much.
Of course, yeah.
This is awesome. I've never been... No one's ever brought a whole like bird on the feather to cooking issues before. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I guess we should answer some high-tech... Dave, we got
any
calls?
Yeah, you want to take a call?
Yeah, as many as we got. We got some... Caller, you're on the air. What do you got?
Hi, Dave. This is Colton from Vail, Colorado.
How you doing?
Doing well. How are you guys?
All right.
Okay, so first of all, big fan of the show and big fan of Liquid Intelligence. I actually use that book a lot more in the kitchen than I do for cocktails. But anyway, great book.
Thank you.
So I got a couple questions. First one is on Ultratex.
Okay. Why are you using Tex and not Spurs, by the way?
I'm sorry?
Why are you using Tex and not Spurs?
It's just what we have at the restaurant I work at.
All right, go ahead.
But anyway, so we make a spinach puree at the restaurant, and we've been having trouble keeping it green for more than a day.
Right.
And one of my chefs said that what he usually does and what usually works for stuff like that is pureeing the spinach, the blanched and shocked spinach, with a little bit of ascorbic acid, Ultratex, and a touch of like some neutral cooking oil. But I don't, after all the research that I've done, I can't find a reason why that would work. Do you have any thoughts on that? Any advice?
No, I don't. I'll say this. So Ultratex for, by the way, I would switch to Spurs. But okay. Like Ultratex is a pre-cooked, starch, right? So,
right.
You know, so what it has the ability to do that a regular starch wouldn't have the ability to do is absorb liquid. So basically what you're doing is just you're just sequestering some of the liquid in with the starch. So maybe that's helping you out a little bit. It's also going to help run out on the puree. So I don't know if it's going to help with the greening, but it's going to help with that gross runoff that spinach puree has. We're all, you know what I'm talking about? You all know what I'm talking about, right? That
when why you squeeze it so hard.
Yeah, that's why you squeeze the ever-loving hell out of it. And that squeeze water also is an ugly color, typically, in my
absolutely
experience.
Right.
The reason I would switch to Spurs is Spurs is what's called – it's the same product as Ultratex, but it's – pre-agglomerated, so it's like it looks more like like Bisquick or something. It dissolves easier. Not that you're going to have that much problem with clumping in spinach puree, but if you were to throw it in pure water, it would. Ascorbic acid is going to prevent any enzymatic action, but the thing you have to worry about with acids is too much acid, and you'll start destabilizing the chlorophyll. But I don't know, Elias, you got any good keeping spinach puree tricks, old school?
I puree it in a blender to keep it really, really cold with ice.
Yeah, keep
so
it super cold.
So I just
cold.
Squeeze it, and like if I do a spinach puree, just blanch it, instantly shock it, squeeze the hell out of the water, add the cooked shallots, puree it just barely in a Vitamix, and then put it instantly on ice.
Yeah,
just
I think
keeping
the,
it cold.
I think the key, for me, the key is to squeezing.
Yeah, get the water out.
Yeah, and like, I'm talking like... Do you do the towel thing?
Yeah. Got it, because it's just going to turn to water and run it. Yeah.
Yeah. For those of you who don't know what we're talking about, you put it in the towel, and then you twist the towel and twist it and twist it and twist it. And twist
Torchon it. Style.
Yeah, yeah. And it and it just, you know, all that liquid comes out. Yeah, so I don't know. Maybe, like, do you get a lot of, if you squeeze the hell out of it, are you still getting a lot of synergesis, a lot of liquid coming out of it?
No, it's pretty, sometimes you can squeeze it so hard, at least for the blender, you have to add a little bit of water.
Yeah.
I mean, so.
But you find that your chef's recipe is working for you or not working for you? You just want to know the mechanism.
Yeah, I mean, I just kind of wanted to prove him right or prove him wrong.
I mean, the best way to prove something right or something wrong is offline at home, make it a different way, keep it for however long, and bring it in and be like, "Hey, chef, I made this. What do you think?" And then see what they see what they say. I mean, the worst way to do it is to change the way it's done on the line.
Yeah.
That's the absolute worst thing you can do.
Go time and you're like,
right.
Yeah, but like, you know, any I'm just going to go ahead and say I'm going to say this and see, Elias, what you think, is that if you do something on your own time with your own product and it's good and you bring it in and your chef won't respect that and take a look at it, maybe you should be working for a different chef.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's got to be a creative conglomerate. You know, it's like fun. I love when anybody comes in. I make, what, 7,000 pounds of sausage a day, and I still listen to people, salami, about the technique that I use. If they have an idea of how to make it more uniform, let's talk. I don't care.
Especially if someone proves it. Like, I'll take any dogma that I'm running down for years. You show me that there's a better way, I will adopt it immediately.
Absolutely.
And I think that's a sign of in any field, that's a sign of intelligence. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I think it's, it becomes problematic when if someone goes so hard on dogma, especially like in print and on TV, that it becomes hard for them to change. But that's when you could tell if someone's a real, if they're really hardcore about what they do and not just about being who they are. You know so what I mean?
True. Absolutely.
Then they'll change. So anyway, do some experiments and shoot us back and say what, tell us what you find out. Dave, you got any spinach freaks on the chat room? Don't think what's going on.
Let me check and get back to you.
Speaking of tips and tricks, we had a walnut question in a couple of weeks ago about how to easily get the tannic skin off of a walnut. Mm-hmm. Now you can buy non-tannic walnuts. I don't know where they get them. Harold McGee gets good ones. I haven't spoken to him yet. Whether he has any tips, but I said I was going to talk to a guy whose grandpa was a walnut farmer, but it turns out he doesn't grow walnuts. He only grows almonds, or almonds, as he calls them.
Almonds.
And it's unfortunate because he would have had this guy, 60 years ago was in an airplane accident. He was flying. He lost his leg and one eye.
Whoa.
And he's still an almond farmer. So I figured if anyone knew how to do it, but, it's easy to get not easy, it's a pain in the butt, but it's technically easy to get the skins off of an almond. But walnuts, I don't know. I mean, can you blanch a walnut?
Yeah, blanch them.
And totally. Do the towel rub?
Yeah, blanch them, then re-roast them, and then chop them, and then do the sieve and try to get the skin through the coarse sieve is the way I do it. And it's still not like a perfectly peeled.
Right, and you can't get I don't forget whether this person wanted whole halves. That's the good thing about an almond is you can get the skin off of it and still have it be in
beautiful shape.
Beautiful shape.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But the good thing about nuts that I think people, as long as you don't soak the bejesus out of them, such that you're actually leaching a bunch of flavor out of them, they can take a good number of get it wet, get it dry, get it wet, get it dry. I mean, they're pretty. Totally. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Especially, you just trade that off with a walnut. Like, if you hate how a tannic almond or a walnut does your tongue and makes it all fucked up, blanch it for a second. Then roasted, at least you'll get all that bitters out of it and the tannin.
Right, because all that stuff is A, on the outside, and B, water soluble. Exactly. That's a good tip right there.
Hey, look at that. For a sausage maker, I know a way around a nut.
Just do good. Well, so do you do that? Do you do the walnut and sausage thing?
Yeah, I do it in pate, once or twice a year. Yeah, I'll make a walnut pate for sure with Nocello and whatnot. I think they're delicious, especially with game birds.
When you serve a pate, what do you think about – remember, 5 or 6 years ago, or maybe even longer now, 10 years ago, the big thing – not in pate. Let's go to foie gras straight, right? Mm-hmm. The big chunk – now, I have to say, are you a hot or a cold? If you could choose only one, would you choose hot or cold?
Foie gras?
Yeah.
That's a tough one, huh? I'm going to go cold because I can have it in more places.
99 out of 100 chefs do that, but I just love hot.
That's
so
delicious
much.
Too. Yeah.
Anyway, what about you, Stas?
Cold.
Mm-hmm. Samantha?
I like cold too.
99 out of 100. I'm I actually really like the old school, just quick sear, lightly warm in the middle, maybe some
peach.
Yeah,
crunchy salt.
Or something. Yeah, whatever.
Keep talking.
Yeah, anyway.
That's awesome.
So,
you want to take a quick break?
Well, one second. So, one thing that makes me upset is when you don't serve it with any form of. No acidic accompaniment and no crunchy starch. I need an acidic accompaniment and I need a crunchy starch. Pate as well. Give me some sort of bread.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Especially have you noticed this where someone will give you a big plate of either pate or something and then nothing to break up the unctuousness.
Absolutely. No. Yeah. You got to have crunchy bread or good bread or baguette for a pate.
An old school French chef shall remain nameless. It was Alain Sayac. They used to do a country pate at the French Culinary Institute. I like country pate as the next guy. And they would put the little cornichon, right? Which I kind of like cornichon. I'm going to say I kind of like cornichon. They're not my favorite
pickle.
I mean, the texture is bad, right? cornichon. The texture is bad.
Yeah, they're a good crunch, but there's better crunches out there.
Yeah, much better crunches. I mean, the cucumber didn't want to be murdered at that age. It wanted to grow bigger.
Yeah, it wanted to be more of a pickle.
It's like the baby corn is garbage. I mean, like, yeah,
that's a true fact.
Yeah, yeah, I like the way they look, kind of like theoretically, but it's garbage. It's a garbage product.
Nothing. It's a garbage product.
Yeah,
that's
it's
true.
A garbage product. So the what do you think, Stas? You hate that stuff, right?
Hate baby corn.
So Samantha,
I agree.
Dave.
Yeah, not a fan.
Yeah, okay. Stop putting those things in cans. First of all, like, where do they get? I mean, like,
that's true. Maybe a really good baby corn is delicious, but I've never had that.
I ripped one right off of a stalk once, and I was like, "This is garbage." And I boiled it. I was like, anyway. But so that's not the point. That's not the point. So I was like, "Hey, chef, you know what would be good?" And he serves it with bread because, come on, he's an old school French guy. I was like, "I really like a coarse grain mustard with my country pate." He's like, American, and walked away.
Yeah.
That's what he said. I was like, "What?
Get out of here! It's
mustard's
the,
good."
Yeah, come on. You always have to remember. You just got to make people happy. If they want a freaking ketchup on it, and that's the way that they enjoyed my pate, more to you.
Right, but
I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to touch the stuff.
But I mean, like, you know, like, don't you think that a coarse grain mustard is a better acidic / pungent accompaniment to a country pate than a freaking cornichon, no matter how French it is?
Absolutely. There, whole grain mustards on every charcuterie board that I sell at every one of my places, no matter what.
Thank God.
It's perfect. It goes with everything. Yeah, versatile. Right? It's bright. It tastes good.
All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back with more Elias Cairo and more cooking issues. This episode is brought to you by Joule, the immersion circulator for sous vide by Chef Steps. If you're listening to this show, you're probably a pretty good cook. Maybe you already know that sous vide is the best way to get a kick-ass juicy steak. And with Joule, a new sous vide tool from Chef Steps, you can do so much more. Smoky tender ribs, homemade yogurt, creme brulee, bright crunchy pickles, vibrant purees, even smooth creamy ice cream, all perfectly cooked every time. Joule is sleek and small enough to fit in your kitchen drawer, and it's operated by an elegant smartphone app that's been designed to remove the guesswork, get you cooking faster, and give you the information and inspiration you want when you want it. Browse Chef Steps' amazing recipes and helpful guides. Choose your perfect doneness for any meat and get notified when your food is ready. You know you'll get great results, so you can focus on sides and sauces, or just pour yourself a cocktail and chill until you're ready for a delicious dinner. For more information and to order yours now, visit chefsteps.com/joule. Trooper, premium British beer, handcrafted by Robinson's Brewery in Cheshire, England, and created by Iron Maiden. That's what we're going to be having with our lunch date. I mean, like, Nastassi, where did this beer come from?
I have no idea. You just brought it. It was like, this is ridiculous.
All right, so I'll give you some props if you can tell me why Iron Maiden is a particularly, for someone like me, an important metal band.
Bass.
Why?
I don't know.
Man played with three fingers.
He only had three fingers?
No, he played with, in other words, like the typical bass player plays with two fingers. Oh. Like thump, thump, thump. He was like, brum, 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 brum. Mm-hmm. What's wrong with you? You know what I mean? How do you not?
What are you doing all day not knowing that?
What are you doing? Failed. Dave, what do you think about it? As a music guy, what are your thoughts? Do you ever listen to that stuff?
They're great, yeah.
Do you, like, you know, like those, the original t-shirts with, what's his name? Eddie, right?
Yeah.
Like, they're like fantastically expensive now.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not surprised. Yeah. There's like a weird vintage rock tea market.
I know. It's crazy. You know, those things were unconscionably expensive at the time they were new. They should go way down in value. That should be the purchase that you get slapped for later. And you're like, I can't believe I spent $40 on that concert t-shirt.
But now you're sitting pretty.
Now you're sitting pretty. It's like old programs. It's like I have the original 77 Star Wars program. And apparently that's worth something. Anyways.
Did you spend $40 for that program?
No, I spent like, I think it might have came with the ticket.
There you go.
You know what I mean? Like, you know, I was a little young. I don't know. Back then, your parents just paid for crap and you didn't know.
True.
You know what I mean? So, Dave, you want me to do this business before we get back into real stuff?
Yes, please.
This is what we call people the mid-roll ad, even though it's coming at the end of the show. This is the mid-roll ad.
Well, I have no control over that, but you do.
Ooh. Are we getting back? We're getting back into this day. It's testy day. Modernist Pantry was created by food lovers and cooking issues fans just like you. Janie, Chris, and the Modernist Pantry family share your passion for experimentation and have everything you need to make culinary magic happen in your own kitchen. Professional chef, home cook, food enthusiast, no matter what your skill or experience, Modernist Pantry has something for you. They make it easy to get the ingredients and tools you need and can't find anywhere else, so you can spend less time hunting and gathering, although you would hate that.
Yeah, who doesn't want to hunt and gather?
Right. And more time creating memorable dishes and culinary experiences. Visit ModernistPantry.com today to discover why Cooking Issues listeners call Modernist Pantry the cook's secret weapon. Be sure to check out their new Kitchen Alchemy. It's not really new anymore, Dave. It's like, you know. Anyway, be sure to check out their new Kitchen Alchemy blog at blog.modernistpantry.com for free recipes, tips, and tricks. And don't forget to follow Modernist Pantry on social media to keep up with what's new and exciting in the world of culinary ingredients and tools.
Great. Nailed it again.
Nailed it. All right, let's do it. Should we do it? We got any more callers?
Yeah, we got one more caller.
Let's do it. Caller, we're on the air.
Hey, Dave, how's it going? This is Jason from Atlanta.
How you doing? How's Atlanta?
I'm doing well.
I hear it's like 8 billion degrees down there. Yeah, you like coming by your Hotlanta name properly now.
Yeah, people who actually live in Atlanta don't actually call it Hotlanta. That's just the outsiders.
Yeah, well, I am, in fact, an outsider. Do you not listen to Ludacris if you're actually from Atlanta, or do you do that?
Well, who doesn't?
Oh, there you go. Okay. You go. All right. So what's
question
up?
Question about fish sauce. So I'm looking to make my own fish sauce, and I was wondering if there's a reason why traditionally oily fish are used, anchovies and sardines, and would it still work with pretty much any other kind of fish, maybe even lake fish, perch, trout, anything? Is there a limitation as to what fish you should and shouldn't use?
Okay, so I'm going to weigh in for a second, and I'm sure Elias has some stuff to say about this. You know, with the Greekness will come in at a certain point. So right. Here's the thing, like, typically, fish sauce is made with like fish that you gather kind of in abundance, and you aren't cooking as a whole kind of a fish. And so, like, you gather lots of these oily fish. Like, you get lots of mackerel, you get lots of sardines, you get lots of anchovies.
Right.
And so, I think that's like one of the reasons. But they're classic ones that are made with squid, and that's not oily. Mm-hmm. Made with the guts.
Right.
You get ones that are made. I mean, typically, you know, most traditional recipes are built around a less waste phenomenon. And so, like, anything that you would, like, stake out or cook, you wouldn't turn into a fish sauce.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there are some fish sauces, like the famous the garum, which is the Roman one, changed a lot depending on what grade you were buying and what era of the Roman Empire you're dealing with. But, like, one of the high grades at a certain time was all guts. So it's just, you know, mackerel guts.
Yeah.
Do you have any experience making – do you ever make fish sauce?
I've never made fish sauce, no.
You should make it. Stuff's delicious. Wow, stinky.
Totally. Yeah.
Delicious.
Yeah, I love it, so I should make it. I can't believe I haven't made it.
Yeah.
So the bottom line is, yes, it should work with pretty much any fish.
Yes, I would say it would work with a lot of fish. There are some people who believe, and I've never done the test, that the smaller fish have a good gut to meat ratio, and that it's the guts that are like kickstarting all of that like stuff that's going on. I've heard people say that. Mm-hmm. Do I have any experience? I don't.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Okay.
Yeah.
And any idea of using? I guess more specifically to the Ishiri squid-based fish sauce, if using frozen squid would be a problem.
I think it should not be a problem, but most of the squid that I buy that's frozen is cleaned already. Do you have a source
of?
Yeah,
you might be right.
I mean, like, the best thing to do is if you get squid is like clean them, scrape all the cleaning stuff into the bucket to make your fish sauce, and then you know, do your whatever you're doing. With the, are you a fan, Elias, of turning the squid inside out before you stuff it? Where you take the mantle and you flip it inside out so that when it cooks, it like squeezes into the stuffing?
No, I've never done that. Yeah. I stuff a lot of squid. I always pipe it into the squid.
Right. Well, this old French guy, he used to like before he would do that, but before he'd do it, he would turn it inside out, and he said he would get a tighter.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
I can't wait to try that.
Yeah. Let me know. It's a Chef Didier. We used to I forget his last name. French guy.
Yeah.
Anyway. Okay. Let us know what's going on.
Dave, I'll give the fish sauce a try using some fish I can catch. And by the way, I'm with you on the foie gras. Hot all the way.
There you go. Someone's got to agree with me at some point.
He's the 1%.
All right, thanks. Let us know how the fish sauce goes.
How do you start the fermentation on a fish sauce?
Just freaking salt.
Just salt and just leave it in there. No mother, nothing. Just ferments on its own. Naturally,
yeah.
It gets crazy.
I mean,
sour.
We started making it once for the same thing I was telling you about. We were in Italy. We were doing the Roman thing. And we just hacked them up and then, like, put salt in.
Yeah.
And now, but I've never like made it through from beginning to end, but mm-hmm. there's a bunch of people now who have done it and made some really high kind of grade, high grade fish sauce. I love fish sauce.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? Fish sauce is, and I'm going to be using a lot more of it now because the kids are pescatarian now.
Oh, so
see how long this lasts, right?
Take the bird. Maybe they'll want some bird.
I'm going to eat the whole bird. But kids aren't. You know what? Here's the thing. Like, I feel that, like, if you make that choice, I'm like, hey, you made that choice.
It's true.
That's your choice.
Yeah. I went vegetarian for a while for a skateboard. My skateboard broke in Salt Lake, and I didn't have any money. And my bud, I ate so much meat being Greek. And they're like, if you go a week without eating meat, we'll buy you a skateboard. And so I, like, took the bet. And then I got a girlfriend who was vegetarian in that week. And I was vegetarian for, like, 3 months.
Wow.
It's pretty impressive.
Wow. So, and then as soon as that relationship ended, back to the meat?
Lamb rib.
Was that part of the reason the relationship ended or no?
No, she just didn't like me anymore.
Wow. Well, because you were spending too much time skateboarding.
Exactly. So, yeah, young.
So what's that dish? What's that Greek dish, the spit roast lamb intestines, where you wrap all the intestines around the spit and then you like cook it like a big party food? What's that called again?
Yeah, I don't know what it's called, but yeah, it's delicious. Absolutely.
You ever make that stuff?
Yeah, well, I make it with goat. Yeah, where we restuff we take out the goat carcass, we debone it, and then we chop up the intestines with the liver, the heart, and the kidney, quickly saute and season that, and then put it inside of the wrapped goat, and then fire roast the whole thing. That's delicious.
Well, here's a question for a couple questions. One, uh-huh. I noticed in your book, I know Nastasia noticed this. I think I bookmarked the page. Your porchetta is not what we would call a porchetta. It's more of like a whole.
Yeah, that's like, what I call a porchetta. Yeah.
Looked good. You see that, Stas?
I want the whole pig.
It's like stuff with I'm obsessed with this Colombian dish, but instead of a meat stuffing, it's meat and rice stuffing.
Oh yeah, that's so good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Crispy, crispy pork skin plus anything,
totally.
Basically.
Yeah.
Win.
Yeah, absolutely.
Win.
Yeah, and that's the big challenge about a porchetta is like anybody could stuff a pork, but getting the skin perfectly crisped up, and there's a million tricks to that.
Oh, are you? What are you a believer? Are you a believer? Do you baking soda it?
No.
Do you prick it?
I prick it and then blanch it.
So I
prick it and then throw hot water over it twice.
Ladle blanch. Or pour over. Yeah, pour over.
Pour over. If I had a pot big enough, I would love to dip it.
But nothing in the water.
Nothing in the water. And then I salt the shit out of it and then leave it overnight in salt and then start with a low temperature.
Right.
And then when it gets to 90 degrees, I crank my oven all the way up until it's just about on fire. And then that turns into its little chicharrones.
And it does the puff
out?
It
pops up and it gets all the holes and all the grease cooks the skin and it's crunchy and then you can just slice it and I love it. Yeah.
Hey Dave, we got to go, but before we do, chat room is demanding an update on the spins all that you promised.
We have this. We have the update. Nastasia is going to send it out. I'm sending. We have the picture of the first off tooling. This is the centrifuge that I'm working on.
Cool.
So we have a video of it of the first off tooling one running, the one that we took to Scotland, and we're going to send that out. And then we'll probably send out a more substantive one next week. And then after I get back from China, we will send out another one. But that's probably the ones we're going to definitely send out before the ship date happens. All right, so we didn't get to we had a question on adding silver powder to a cocktail. I don't think it's necessarily a good idea. Do you know that – you know colloidal silver? You guys heard of colloidal silver?
Mm-hmm.
So people take colloidal silver, and this is not the same thing, but some people think it has a health thing. But if you drink too much of it, you turn blue permanently. Like the silver gets into your skin.
Not
and
a good look.
Generally not a good look.
Bruised up.
You look like – you remember in Appalachia there were these there was this group of people that – they were blue naturally, like they had some sort of like genetic thing.
Ooh.
So you look, you end up looking kind of like that, which is kind of messed up. Yeah.
All
right, Wes, next week I'll talk to you about deep fryers and what deep fryer I use and how to choose a deep fryer and all that good stuff. Choose a deep fryer wisely. Someday maybe I should invent, someone wanted me to invent, like work on a new oven after this spins all, but I think like a really good, I'm not going to do this for, but a really good deep fryer that like a regular person could use
in your house. Yeah.
Because like a real deep fryer is like so much better than the one you get in your
like
house.
A fried daddy one.
Yeah.
Make like what, like the home version of a broaster. Like in the West Coast, we have those like deep fried chicken places where it's a pressure deep fryer. And
right.
You cook the hood and throw the chicken in.
Yeah, I met the guy. I think, did he die? He's still alive. Anyway, speaking of died, the guy who invented G.I. Joe died. We could talk more about that later. Anything else next week? We'll talk about next week. Oh, next week we have Richard Blaze coming on. So any sort of Richard Blaze questions you have, you can dial in. Thanks for coming. Thanks, guys. Thanks so much for showing up.
Us.
I had a good time. Cooking
great.
Issues.
for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.